The public meeting of the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee to order. And the first item of business, we're going to take the bottom item on the agenda and do a quick work session on House Bill 3053. So open a work session on House Bill 3053. And a bit of oversight. We left some things in that bill that we needed to pull out. So I would accept a motion to suspend the rules for purposes of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3053.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Here, Mr. Starr moves. And is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Our motion for the pass-through.
What we need to do is that's the entire process of
actually we need the we now need to vote to reconsider.
Right.
That was just a suspension of the rules. And now we need to vote.
Okay, so that's just I got a motion to reconsider the vote by which they moved out the bill.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Okay. We've got a motion before us to reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 3053 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Bill is back.
The bill is back.
Now we can send the dash twos.
We need to strip out the dash twos. The dash threes that are before us have the content of the dash twos in them, so it's simplest to remove the dash twos from the bill and add in the dash threes. The dash threes take out some language that was controversial related to reporting, and also have the content of the dash twos included in them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The way I read the dash three, they would replace the dash twos by deleting page 2 through 5. They appear to be a gut and stuff.
It's a gut and stuff related to the original bill, but does not relate to the dash two
modified. Okay. So I would move that we bring through the vote at which we pass the dash two amendment.
Okay. Colleagues, have a motion for us to reconsider the vote which we inserted the dash two amendments into the bill. Any objection? Hearing none, ordered. Representative Beyer? Do I remove the dash twos then?
Chair, I would now move that we rescind the dash twos.
Amendment to House Bill 3053. Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'll go back to the original bill.
Add in the dash three.
If no one else would say to do so, I will move the dash three amendments to the House Bill 3053.
Okay, colleagues, have a motion to move the dash three amendments to House Bill 3053. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Heard the motion, colleagues. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative, we have brought House Bill 3053 back into our possession. We have removed the dash twos, and we have reinserted the dash threes, which includes the language of the dash twos, along with removing the controversial reporting language that was included in the dash threes, okay, in the original bill. So now we are moving the bill to the floor to do pass recommendation. Okay. And
there's no objection.
None.
Okay. Hearing none, and the bill goes before the due pass recommendation. I think Representative Devlin was the carrier.
Mannix
is the carrier. Okay, we will leave the bill with Mannix then to carry, and that will close the discussion on House Bill 3053. And now we will go to the first item on our agenda, which is a public hearing on Senate Bill 535. And open public hearing on Senate Bill 535. And
Mr. Chair, committee members, on SB 535-A, the bill reduces maximum personal income tax rate for capital gains to 4%. It reduces corporate income tax rate for capital gains to 4%. It applies to the years beginning January 1, 2002. Current capital gains are taxed at ordinary income 5%, 7%, or 9%, depending on the taxable income of the taxpayer. Currently, corporate capital gains are taxed at a net income at 6.6%, Senate vote, ayes 19, nays 11.
Representative, does Senator Miller want to come over and testify on this bill? Would you put in a call to Senator Miller's office and ask if he wants to come over and testify on this bill? And while we're at it, we will go ahead and proceed with those who signed up today and take them in order. Charles Sheketoff. Please introduce yourself to the record and jump right into it.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charles Sheketoff. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, a nonprofit research institute located in Silverton that examines budget, tax, and program issues that are important to low and moderate income Oregonians, the majority of Oregonians. I've distributed to you here, and your offices have also received copies of an analysis that was completed for us by the Washington, D.C.-based Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, looking at what's the impact of Senate Bill 535. Before I discuss the specifics of that, I'd like you to first, for a moment, imagine that I am Bill Scott, the head of the Economic Development Department, and you are now the Ways and Means Committee. Imagine me sitting before you today and saying, I would like to spur economic development in this state by giving people money that they can invest anywhere in the world, not just in Oregon. And I'm asking you to give me an appropriation of $200 million so that I can give $16 apiece to 80% of your constituents, and I can give $7,700 to the 1% of your constituents that earn over $720,000 a year. I think you would not probably support that type of appropriation because it wouldn't be fair or an appropriate use of state resources. That's what this bill does. The analysis before you shows that 53% of the tax reduction from this capital gains reduction would go to the 1% of Oregonians who have an average income of $720,000 a year and income that exceeds $271,000. And their average tax cut would be $7,770. The poor 20% would be effectively be excluded from the tax cut with an average reduction of just 4 cents. 80% of Oregonians earning less than households earning less than $63,000 annually would receive 10% of the tax cut in Senate Bill 535 and an average amount of $16. Capital gains represent less than 5% of the income for all but the wealthiest 5% of Oregon's residents, and over 50% of all taxable gains are realized by the wealthiest 1%. With an average income of $720, as I said. Reducing the tax on capital gains would significantly reduce the share of taxes paid by Oregon's wealthiest while increasing the share of taxes paid by the rest of Oregon's taxpayers. Also, because on the federal level you can deduct your state income taxes if you're an itemizer, about over one quarter, about 28% of the savings in Oregon, taxpayers, the $220 million, would end up getting sent to the federal government. If you're an itemizer, you can deduct state tax liability when configuring your federal tax liability. There's been a bunch of bills regarding, a number of bills regarding capital gains. In 1995, the legislature passed a deferral program on capital gains and told the Legislative Revenue Office, the Department of Revenue, and the Economic Development Department to analyze the effectiveness of that deferral program. And the report of that was submitted to the Senate Revenue Committee on March 30th report that said the capital gains deferral program isn't working. And it had a pretty extensive literature research, and they cited a number of studies, such as one by a person named Cherniak, who could not find statistical support for the hypothesis suggesting that higher state income taxes on higher income individuals causes slower economic growth by causing out-migration. It's not that it doesn't occur, it just wasn't of a discernible impact on economic growth. And it essentially said the deferral program report by those three entities, your Legislative Revenue Office, your Department of Revenue, and your Economic Development Department, said the capital gains deferral program essentially really wasn't doing much to help the Oregon economy. This bill would actually do less because it would allow the capital gains deferral program was having to do with investments in Oregon and maintaining them in Oregon. These are capital gains investments anywhere in the world. They have nothing. They have no direct tie to Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for coming today. Questions from the committee? Representative Starr?
Thank you. Mr. Sotokoff, does this study do anything to recognize the fact that if you lower the capital gains rate, that there might actually be more turnover of those dollars, would actually get more money into the economy, more economic activity, more opportunity for actually increased revenue through additional income tax collected by the state?
The Chairman, Representative Starr, the report discusses how there has been, as the author is right, much ink spilled evaluating the legitimacy of the argument that capital gains leads to increased investment and economic growth. But it notes that a state-specific capital gains incentive must encourage investment within the borders for that to happen. So what you're getting is, this is because this is investment in capital gains, whether it's an investment in outside the state or whatever, there's no target for Oregon. The capital gains deferral program said if you invest in Oregon and you have a capital gain off of it, and within a certain amount of time you put it back into another Oregon investment, we'll let you defer your capital gain. And that kept it as an Oregon-focused economic development, and it frankly wasn't working. This one says capital gains, whether you made them on an investment in China, Alabama, Mississippi, or Oregon. And so state-specific ones generally just aren't going to help the economy of Oregon. It's tenuous at best to suggest that this would help the economy.
So the answer is basically no, they didn't do any kind of study to find out what it would do. They just said it's been a lot of talks, but they didn't do any study.
The Chairman, Representative Carr, they looked at the literature and summarized the literature, which is that state-specific ones do not work if they're not targeted to capital investments here. Your legislative revenue office and your Department of Revenue and Economic Development Department did do a study, and their study of the Oregon capital gains deferral program was essentially that it wasn't working very well. It was not effective.
Mr. Edwards?
Chuck, you've seen a revenue impact. There's question marks on the corporate side. Do you know what those are? And they look at that?
The Chairman, Representative Edwards, good question. 2 points about the revenue impact. On the corporate side, I think it's very hard to tell what the revenue impact is, and the micro-simulation model that the Institute for Taxation uses isn't able to do that. There's actually a bill pending and left the House Revenue Committee. It's in the House Ways and Means Committee on the House side to do what's called a tax incident study, which was a recommendation of the governor's tax reform group, which would allow us to know what the incidence is and to spend some money to create the model to be able to do that. I think it's important to note that the revenue impact is none next biennium, because it doesn't start till 2002, which allows you, some people don't like back-ended tax rates outright. I think actually, analytically, they're okay, because they get you to first focus on the policy, and then if the policy's good, you say, should we straddle future legislators with the fiscal, and how does it relate to other fiscal priorities of the state? This one, however, fails on the first question. On the policy, it's a bad policy. And so you don't have to worry about the money. Oftentimes on tax breaks and tax cuts, people focus on the money. This way, you can focus on the policy. And the policy here is bad. It's giving the wealthiest 1% over half the tax break, and they're giving 80% of your constituents $15 a year. And there's no tie or target to the state economy. But the corporate, you don't know. And that's another thing. I think the question mark is, you'd be basically spending money. It'd be like, again, imagine you're the Ways and Means Committee, and I'm a bureaucrat asking for some money, and I say, I don't know what it's going to cost you. Just give me the money. Give me a blank check to run this program. That's what this bill's asking for on the corporate side. Your staff has not been able to come up, the legislative staff, and the revenue office, at least, has not been able to come up with an estimate of cost.
President Edwards.
Well, on that, could you just explain for the record why that's so hard to compensate?
You need to have a model that looks at all the different tax returns someone has to create that type of model that does the predictions and looks at how capital gains are made and who's making them. On the corporate side, sometimes they're made by tax businesses that are tax exempt. My guess is it's probably less than the personal income side, I guess, but I wouldn't know. Your revenue office can't guess it. I would not want to venture a guess.
Representative Matt?
Thank you. I'd like to know whether or not anybody's going to pay higher taxes as a result of this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, the answer to that question is perhaps, given that it's a back-ended tax break that a future legislature, when it gets fully implemented, is going to have almost $500 million less money. They may be forced to raise taxes to meet the basic needs of the state.
I may follow up.
Okay, man.
Well, then the hypothesis is that because there are certain tax reductions in this bill, although there are no actual increases on anyone in this bill, someday someone may have to pay higher taxes because government will need more money. And since this bill reduces taxes, that could happen in the future. Couldn't I make that argument about any bill that reduces taxes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, yes, you could, and that's not the basis of my opposition to the bill. My opposition to the bill is that over half the tax rate goes to 1% of your constituents who have an average income of over $700,000, and 80% of your constituents will get $16 out of this, that it has no clear economic benefit to the state of Oregon because it's only encouraging capital gains investments no matter where they are, anywhere on the globe or cyberspace.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
does that assume that we should be setting the capital gain tax rate in such a fashion as to encourage particular kinds of investments as opposed to a neutral policy that says we encourage investments, period?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, as I said earlier, you actually in 1995, the legislature did do that with a capital gains deferral program and required the Revenue Department, the Economic Development Department, and the Legislative Revenue Department were required to report back to this legislature on the effectiveness of that program. The report dated March 30 was presented to the Revenue Committee. I don't know if all the members get copies. And that found essentially that after the first 2 years, it wasn't working very well. It was a targeted capital gains break. And it predicted it won't do much better in the future. That capital, there's a lot of literature that mixed feelings on whether capital gains rates can, in fact, affect the ability. And what this does do is actually it results, as I mentioned, the state would lose $220 million. The feds would gain money. It raises the federal taxes because people say, so you're basically, the net gain to taxpayers, you can't say we're giving taxpayers a $220 million year tax break, you give them less than that, so $60 million going off to the federal government. You're raising their taxes as well.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Nesbitt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon State Council of SEIU, which represents 28,000 public and private sector workers in Oregon. We're here in opposition to Senate Bill 535, which I can describe as a multi-million-dollar giveaway to our least needy taxpayers, wealthy individuals and corporations, at the expense of funding for schools, higher education, criminal justice, health services, and all the other programs supported by the general fund of our state. Incredibly, SB 535 singles out just one form of income for special tax treatment, not wages, which are the primary support for our working families in Oregon, or pensions or interest income, which are important to seniors, but gains on investment that benefit primarily our wealthiest taxpayers. If Senate Bill 535 takes effect, wages would still be taxed at 5%, 7%, and 9%, but capital gains would be rewarded with a preferential tax rate of 4%. Now, AOI will argue that a capital gains tax cut is intended to encourage savings and investment, but that ignores the most basic reason why too many of us save too little. Too many of us earn too little. Unlike proposals that would provide more assistance to low-wage workers, like making the working family child care credit and the earned income tax credit refundable, this bill does little or nothing to benefit the lowest 20% of taxpayers who already share the largest tax burden as a percentage of their personal income. I've attached a chart on the back of the packet that shows you the most recent analysis done by Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy and shows that in Oregon, when you add up all state and local taxes as a percentage of personal income, the tax burden is highest and heaviest on the lowest 20%. And it's that lowest 20% of our taxpayers who I may have misstated when I said we'll get no benefit. I understand from Mr. Chekatov's presentation, those taxpayers were going to average tax cut of 4 cents a year. Also, Senate Bill 535 has a significant windfall effect by extending its preferential tax rates to gains on all investments as opposed to new investments. It rewards investors for decisions already made and gains already achieved under the existing tax system. This amounts to a tax giveaway with no concomitant benefit other than more money in the bank accounts of successful investors. Further, Senate Bill 535 extends its tax breaks to corporations as well as individuals. Even in the federal tax code, which allows lower tax rates for capital gains realized by individuals, corporations are not accorded such preferential tax treatment for their capital gains. Senate Bill 535 will encourage the reclassification of corporate profits in Oregon to capital gains, and in the future, reward passive profits on investments over operating profits achieved through the active management of core business activities. Finally, Senate Bill 535 is fiscally irresponsible. Even if a case can be made for reducing capital gains tax rates, so we don't believe a compelling case can be made for such a tax cut, this bill pushes off huge costs to future biennials, creating a multi-billion dollar problem for future legislatures. According to LRO, the bill would give up more than $267 million in general fund revenues in 2001-2003 and more than $441 million in 2003-2005. Again, all for the benefit of individuals and corporations who profit from their investments in stocks, bonds, real estate, and other assets. And by the way, the actual revenue impact is unknown since the tax rate for corporations who would be able to declare capital gains as opposed to operating profits cannot be estimated. Revenue losses of this magnitude will force budget cuts with serious consequences for Oregon's children, for the poor, for the elderly and disabled. And I've attached a chart to you that I've used in other testimony under the committees. What $1 million buys in our current budget? Just to give you an idea of what $220 million would mean in this budget impact. For instance, just $1 million currently is enough to educate 200 students per year in K-12. Provides medical coverage under the Oregon Health Plan for 1,121 children between the ages of 1 and 18 per year. Could provide 265 full scholarships to the University of Oregon. Provides prenatal care and deliveries for 324 women through the Oregon Health Plan. Could house 40 prisoners a year. Will provide year-round in-home care for 79 disabled persons. Multiply that $1 million by 267 and you get an idea of the impact in the first biennium. Multiply that by 441, you get an idea of the impact in the second biennium. In the alternative, if such budget cuts are not acceptable, we'll be forced to consider other tax options to make up for the losses. So the questions are, will wage earners be expected to make up the difference, or will the cost be borne by our school children and senior citizens? Either way, we believe that Senate Bill 535 will be bad for Oregon, and we urge you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Quiet today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead. Representative Mannix here.
Well, I think we should probably miss him out of the outside.
I'll be back.
Gary Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, Gary Carlson with Associated Oregon Industries. We asked that Senate Bill 535 be introduced on the Senate side. I might add that we had a similar bill introduced on the House side. In addition, we had two other tax reduction concepts we had for introduction on both the House and the Senate side, one of which would have raised the federal tax deduction limit, which did pass out of the Senate Revenue Committee, now resides in the Ways and Means Committee. That bill raises the limit from $3,000 to $5,000, and it primarily benefits the broad mass of middle-class taxpayers. We also ask for introduction of a bill which would exempt from state income taxation interest earned, which tends to benefit mostly the lower income spectrum of Oregon's taxpayers. This bill is the bill that has moved the furthest thus far in this legislative session. I'd just like to make the following points, which are outlined for you in my handout. This bill, I think, far from being a giveaway to the rich, is something that we ought to do for the broad taxpayers of Oregon, who are earning and investing and saving for their future retirements or education for their children or other major cost items. Stock ownership by U.S. citizens, individual citizens in this country is now at an all-time high of about 50%. And more citizens are saving and investing for their future retirement. Saving outside of IRAs or other tax-advantaged retirement plans are subject to capital gains taxes when sold and reinvested. You probably had this experience as I have. Talk to a Gen Xer or even a dot-comer who doesn't believe they're going to receive Social Security and has started to save and invest for their long-term self-benefit and who are not very familiar with the tax code and either decide that they have a nice gain in an asset in which they have invested and decide to sell it and then are tapped for roughly 30% of it by the federal and state government. If you want to hear somebody scream, as I have more than once, that's a life's learning experience. And what it teaches you is that there's a one item that you can't overlook if you're investing for your future, and that is never sell if you've got a gain, because you're going to pay a substantial amount of it out to the federal government and to the state government. And that's what we're talking about with capital gains when we talk about the lock-in effect. A lock-in effect is that you get hammered if you're going to sell an asset and make a gain, so you simply don't sell. Capital gains are not indexed for inflation, and the income tax on capital gains is in part a tax on inflation. And when you are saving and investing for long-term gains, you have substantial portions of that gain over time that represents simply inflationary pressures in the economy. Investors suffered large tax increases in capital gains in 1986 when the Federal Tax Reform Act was passed. Capital gains was increased from 20% to 28% by the federal government. The next year, Oregon followed suit, eliminated the 60% exclusion from tax on a gain of sale of an asset in which there was a capital gain. And that elimination of the exclusion raised Oregon's rate on capital gains from 4% to 9% from 1 year from 1986 to 1987. In 1997, almost 2 years ago now, Congress reduced the capital gains rate to as low as 18%. And in our view, Oregon needs to follow suit for the long-term benefit of its citizens to return again to the 4% rate, which we had prior to federal change, which triggered our increase in 1987. Retirees with substantial retirement investments outside of sheltered retirement funds will find it advantageous and do find it advantageous to move to Washington State or Nevada, if they like a warm climate, where there are no capital gains taxes or, in fact, no personal income taxes at all. Successful business owners will be less likely to move to Washington State to avoid capital gains taxes if the rate is reduced. And saving is an investment, the engine of our economy, both at the state level and nationally, will be encouraged with a reduction in the tax on capital gains. The numbers that you have before you from the Legislative Revenue Office, I might add, are based on a static model, which I think your staff has already mentioned to you briefly. A static model simply means that behavior does not change. These will be the financial impacts, and as you see, there is no impact next legislative biennium, and the first impact will be felt in the biennium following the next biennium. But in reality, the tax changes do not result in a static model impact. Tax changes have an effect on people's behavior and taxpayers' behavior. And as we talked about the lock-in effect, reducing that lock-in effect, allowing people to move assets to other investments where there is a greater opportunity for gain without hitting them quite so hard on tax on the gain when they do so, will change those numbers and reduce those loss numbers dramatically over time. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm pleased that they're here in the building tonight. Thank you.
Representative Manning.
Thank you. If I may, Mr. Chair, may I use the green board over there for purposes of a flight demonstration?
That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, you heard some testimony about that filthy red. I wanted to ask you, argument. If this is the average range of government benefits up and down were paid by the typical taxpayer. Would it be fair to say that under the current tax
system,
we have a number of people who are what I'll call the working poor or the working low-income folks who actually pay taxes at a rate below the benefits that they receive, and we have other folks who somewhere in the upper income ranges pay taxes well in excess of the benefits that they receive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I think the numbers will demonstrate that, that the vast amount of the total taxes paid are paid by a very relatively small percentage at the upper end of the income scale.
Would it be fair to say that the nefarious bill, I say that lightly, will just trim here and trim here the tax burden on people who are already paying more than their share?
Yeah, essentially, Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, I think that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Just in a slight disagreement with Representative Mannix, in reality, while the people that are in the uppermost level do pay a large amount of the tax burden, most of the tax burden is paid by middle-income Oregonians. I'm going to say that's correct, because I look at it from the perspective of any time you try to propose a tax rate that's broad-based, the impact in terms of revenue loss is significant. We could get actual percentages, but it goes to the same question as often people say, well, you could solve your problem if you just tax the richest, and you probably couldn't, because you'd have to tax them at almost almost a level of confiscation to actually to generate the type of revenue that you want to generate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dillon, I think that those numbers are readily available from the Legislative Revenue Office. If you're interested in taking a look at those as a committee, they have those numbers available for you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative
Devlin. Thank you. Well, I'd long to be back on the Revenue Committee, and I appreciate being back on it.
Good times in the Revenue Committee.
Definitely, Representative Devlin. Let's just talk tax theory a little bit. I mean, this does have a certain benefit for really a certain group of the population, and that's fair. I mean, I think there is an issue here about how, you know, a lot of people, as you indicated here, are investing in the stock market, and more are accessing the stock market. So maybe you do need to rethink the capital gains in that light. But if we're trying to get at the issue of, I guess, tax, I don't want to say fairness, that becomes a cliche, but if we're trying to provide some relief to the taxpayer, this seems to me more segmented than to try to do something like Representative Devlin was talking about, which is changing tax rates. How are we supposed to, I mean, this is one proposal, and there's always been discussion about tax reform in this state. I mean, how does this fit, in your mind, for the broad tax system that we have? Because I think this is driving one piece of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, I think, in my view, this measure simply backtracks on what I would consider for our economy and our society a bad decision in 1986 to eliminate a 60% exclusion of capital gains, which was intended to do two things. First of all, offset the effect of inflation on long-term held investments. And number two, to provide an incentive for people to save and invest, as opposed to taxing them at the same rate as wage income, and thereby to promote savings investment rather than current consumption.
I remember the 86 tax code, they also lowered the rates and simplified it for on the personal side. I mean, there was a, for, I don't know if it's quid pro quo, but there was an adjustment the other way. You're suggesting that, and obviously the state income tax wasn't changed at the time we raised this, I assume, correct?
The state income tax in 1987?
Yes.
The state attempted to follow the broad scope of the federal changes, and the rates were broadly were lowered, the regular rates, and they followed suit on the many changes that the federal government made, one of which was the elimination of the 60% exclusion on gasoline.
Okay. Interesting. I'm out of questions right now. I'll ask you some later.
I anticipate that this is a very welcome prospect for a reduction in the capital gains tax rate. That the individuals I have worked with over the years started several little investment clubs, and there's always a lot of complaining about how large a chunk capital gains ate up. It's refreshing to me to see us considering the reduction in that rate. So, yes.
Mr. Chairman, also, there's a factor in economics, velocity, I think is the term, which is the turnover of dollars. And it seems to me that you impede velocity the more you tax any particular transaction. And as you reduce the taxation on that transaction to encourage people, as you said, to be willing to pull out a bad investment or reap the gains of a good one before those gains dissipate, you move that money, and the tendency is probably to reinvest. What you're doing is, as you go through that process, you're also feeding some other money into the economy, the people who service the transaction. The people who reap the benefits may spend some of that money on other things in society. So actually, there's some economic enhancement when people are in some sort of a reasonable basis reinvesting. I guess you could get to the point where they're reinvesting too much and that churns the system. But basic economics always told me that the velocity was a good thing, increased velocity rather than a bad thing.
Mr. Chair, indeed, that's the reverse. It's called the lock-in effect, it's, you know, simply that. It's not the highest economic benefit for society to have those investments locked in and not moving to the highest possible economic use of those dollars.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, there was one piece of Mr. Nesbitt's testimony that I would agree with wholeheartedly, and that was that too many of us earn too little. And in my experience, in my efforts at investing, and those in the investment club I mentioned were guys at the plywood plant that burned up the other day. And sitting around the lunchroom table debating good labor jobs, and you pull your money and have a little investment club and pick your stocks and things, but there's a lot of chagrin, and people weren't pleased at all when you go to sell something and you get hit with these capital gains taxes. And I think the reduction in this tax would help many of us earn more. So this would be a good effort, I think, in helping us begin to see some equity financially. Further questions? Give you a chance to talk to you a little bit.
Yeah, I'll talk a little more about this. Actually, Edwards, have you had any analysis done or any thoughts about what the corporate side would be of this? I suppose, to me, passing question marks is always kind of disturbing, but do you have any thoughts about what that might look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I do not, and I noted that those who have a lot more economic training than I do could not come up with a number either.
Well, yes. Let me ask you this question. What's the rationale for the corporate side?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't think there's a rationale other than we're making a change in the tax code. We believe that the codes where we can deal with these items, such as capital gains, that they ought to be broad-based. When you're operating a business in the form of a corporation, an S corporation, C corporation, what have you.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, has any indication of the governor's office how he views this particular piece of legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I can only respond that there was a less than enthusiastic response noted in the media, in the newspaper, following the passage of the bill in the Senate. Other than that, I do not have any information about the governor's views on the bill.
Perhaps we should consider putting a little referral clause on the end of this bill.
For, say, the November 2000 general election, Mr. Chairman?
That would be appropriate, I think.
Empowering the people again?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, that ballot's going to be really long.
You know, if something tells me it's on there, you'll be able to find it. It really does.
Mr. Chairman, we need, if I may,
uh-huh.
We need to remember that we are splitting up the empowerment of the people so that there'll be a special election this November. There'll be some other measures on the ballot next May, and then in November of 2000, there can be a few more, plus whatever initiatives the citizens themselves put together. But this could expand our conversation with the people.
Well, bear that in mind. We won't be moving this bill today, and that's certainly an option. We may be even able to do that conceptually. So we can have one drafted up.
Populism reigns.
Populism reigns. Here, here. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Terry Lamarge.
You only need 3/5 to raise taxes.
That's good.
Okay.
Good point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Lammers. I'm with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm the state issues coordinator. I'm also a woodland owner in Polk County, and the Oregon Small Woodlands Association supports Senate Bill 535. And investment in timber is quite a bit different than most investments. It's of a very long-term nature. I like to compare it to a zero-coupon bond. A zero-coupon bond is where a bond that you pay the money up front, but you don't derive any benefit, any dividend, for many years in some cases. That's what a timber investment is like. You take the money up front and you wait 20, 30, 40, 50, or on the east side as long as a century, before you get any benefit from that. And I ask members of this committee, I'm glad that Representative Beyer is not here, how many of you would invest, say, for 50 years, expecting a return on something that could burn up, be taken away by initiatives, be taken away by disease, insects, etc.? We also support this bill because the current taxation rate and system on capital gains provides no incentive for landowners to make these long-term investments. If a landowner makes a $10,000 investment in establishing a forest and harvests that forest 48 years later, and inflation has averaged 3% in that 48-year period, that $10,000 becomes the equivalent, because of inflation, of $40,000 in that 48-year period. Yet the current taxation policy of the state and of the federal government also includes that $30,000 difference, which is actually a return on capital. It is not a gain. Includes that as a taxable income. I believe that's totally incorrect and should be corrected, and this bill will make a step toward correcting that inequity. And with that, I would answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for coming today, Terry. Questions from the committee?
One.
Yes. That's the devil.
Since you were talking about investing over a long term, how would you feel if the committee considered an amendment to phase this in over even longer period of time than it's currently phased in?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, as to the phase-in period, I don't know if we'd have any major view on that one way or the other. But because of the extremely long-term investment that we make, I think we would love to see it indexed with a massive exclusion if a person or company holds that investment for, let's say, a 30 or 40-year period. That's what we'd really like.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Don Schellenberg, he's still in the room?
He has the estimate that he couldn't make it, but he also supports it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify today on Senate Bill 535A? Seeing none, we will close the work session, or at least we're on public hearing. We will recess the public hearing. We want to come back to it a little bit later. We won't be moving that bill today, however, and we will then open a public hearing on Senate Bill 722. Do we have a sign-up sheet for that bill? Give us an overview, would you, Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 722A provides pension plus annuity benefits for public employees establishing membership in the public employee retirement system after January 1st, 2000. The Tier 3 type system specifies the pension shall be based on formula and annuity based on employee contribution. Summary for this is very extensive and long, and also as a part of your packet, there's a letter from the governor in which he supports provisions of the lump sum with withdrawals and the part that allows employees to get out of first. And he mentions a couple of other items. Also in your packet, a letter from the city of Portland addressing the unfunded liability dealing with cities and also their support for SB 722. In your packet, a letter from the city of Eugene, which also puts their support in terms of helping cities maintain a stable and well-funded retirement system and address the unfunded liability. We have in our packet a dash A8, which addresses the protective optional retirement plans. And then there's a dash 9, which eliminates from the bill RIS 238.215, which deals with contribution by certain higher education employees. And I understand there are some other amendments out there yet to be received by the committee.
Already, were you able to contact the senator or senator? I'm calling it off. You go first. And while we're getting a hold of them, I think what we'll do is call Grant and Karen. And the A9 is yours, isn't it, Grant?
A8 and A9.
A8 and A9 are both yours.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grant and Karen, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. With me is Denise Junker, who is the benefits director for the Oregon University System here on the A8 and A9 amendment. We visited with all members of the committee about the amendments, and we'll try to be brief, and we'll defer to the legislative proponents of the measure if they arrive and will return at your request, Mr. Chairman. So if you see them come in, we'll stand here.
I greatly appreciate your cooperation.
Ms. Junker and I testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee when 722 and its other members' bills in this package were first addressed. The Chair, Bryant, and the members of the committee agreed that the intent to separate our non-PERS optional retirement plan for academic and unclassified employees was a good idea. We all agreed that that would happen. The amendment was lifted on those that should be drawn. In addition, we said the Section 4 needed to be deleted. It shouldn't be included because that it refers to a plan which is no longer available to anyone. The door closed on that December 31, 1995. So conforming that closed option with the intent of 722 was not necessary. But in the case of everybody, somebody, and nobody, Everybody agreed we had to do that. Somebody should have tracked it. Nobody did. The bill was compiled so that the amendment to separate the optional retirement plan was not included, and the deletion, which should have taken place, was not. When we read the A and Gross bill, Ms. Junk and I returned to Senators Bryant and Gerstler. They agreed that they would have no objection to what's coming forward. Senator Bryant's office requested these amendments. They were delivered to him. He has seen them and approves of them. Ms. Junker has spoken to Senator Gerstler and has no objection. As background, let me tell you very briefly what they do. In 1995, the Oregon University System came forward with legislation to create an optional retirement program for primarily for our academic personnel to allow them to have an optional retirement plan so that we could have a recruiting advantage. As it is, people would be asked to come here, and the only option they would have would be to have a fixed contribution in the CDRS, which would not be portable should they go, and into which they could not bring the assets of some other pension system. Most of those academic recruitees are engaged in one of the national educational retirement plans, TIAA CREF, or one of the others, which are available to those that class of employee. This allows them to have that same option here and to have it portable. The legislature approved it, I believe, with no opposition in 1995, and it was proven to be a worthwhile process. When it was amended, we thought that that would be it for PERS legislation for quite a while. Little did we know that both legislative and judicial activity would create a complete change in the landscape and bring us back to an overhaul of TDRS. The problem is that our optional retirement plan is linked to the contribution rates that the person would otherwise get had they chosen to be in PERS instead of the optional retirement plan. And the A8 amendments simply allow us to maintain the optional retirement plan as it is now, so that we would continue to go straight. If Senate Bill 722 becomes law and it goes in another direction, we would be divorced from those changes. So it would simply say, you maintain the status quo as we find it today and as it has been enforced since 1996, and continue that into the future. The simplest way to describe the impact is that if the optional retirement plan is allowed to be impacted by a third tier, it will degrade the value of it as a recruiting tool and won't help PERS. And if the optional retirement plan amendment in A8 is adopted, it will help us and not affect PERS. So that the commonsensical thing, I think, would be to adopt the A8, allow the optional retirement plan to go on, and we would then be able to maintain it. The A9 is much more straightforward. That's simply a housekeeping amendment which says that if you look at Section 4, makes reference to an option which is no longer available to anyone in the Oregon University system, and thus does not need to be conformed to the impact of this bill, is best left out of the measure. Respond to any questions you might have, Mr. Chairman.
I don't have any questions at this time, Grattan. Do the members of the committee have any questions at this time? And we'll be hearing this bill again, so I would appreciate if you kind of, if you'd like to be available for questions.
You'd be putting it on for work session tomorrow?
We may, in fact, move to work session by tomorrow.
All right, sir. So.
Okay. What I'm going to do now is call several members, several individuals who are here to testify in support. Helen Berg, the mayor of the city of Corvallis, Fred McDonald, actually checked the neutral box, so Maria Keltner and John Ramage. And you'd like to come up also? Come on. Up here pretty quick. Okay, introduce yourself to the record one at a time and proceed. We'd like to try to limit this to about 20 minutes if we can, plus questions, and we'll do the same with those in opposition to the measure. So.
Good afternoon, Chair Simmons and members of the committee. I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties, and I have with me today Helen Berg from the City of Corvallis and Bob Cantine from the Association of Oregon Counties. Helen would like to lead off.
Chairman Simmons and members of the committee, thank you for giving us this opportunity to speak today with respect to Senate Bill 722A, which we support.
Need to have you
get modified. Pardon me?
Just give your name.
Everything except my name, yes. My name is Helen Berg, and I'm the mayor of the city of Corvallis.
Thank you very much.
I wish to express our support for Senate Bill 722. It modifies the law governing the public employee retirement system, and this bill, as it is currently amended, addresses a number of structural defects in the PERS system, which have contributed to an $11.7 million unfunded liability and a 46% increase in the City of Corvallis contribution rate for fiscal year 1999-2000. This rate increase translates to just under $1 million per year that must come from property taxes or our utility ratepayers. Without the proposed changes, the city would anticipate similar rate increases every 2 years for the foreseeable future. So I think you can understand why this is a critical issue for my city. As chairman of the League of Oregon Cities Finance and Taxation Committee and as a member of the LOC board, I know that Corvallis' concerns are shared by many cities. The League's membership has endorsed a comprehensive approach as we review the PERS system, and we believe that Senate Bill 722 addresses the most critical changes needed in the PERS system, including the very important variable earnings mismatch and the timing of interest allocations. The proposed Tier 3 would allow public employees to continue to earn market rates on their money and increase their retirement benefits. The employer's liability for Tier 3 retirees would become predictable and affordable without creating additional unfunded liabilities. Senate Bill 722 would also allow local governments to opt out of PERS. Although Corvallis does not presently plan to opt out of PERS, subsequent rate increases could make remaining in PERS an untenable prospect, especially when tax revenue is declining. We do understand that this is a aspect of this bill which is under negotiation. The City Council and I agree that public employees should have a pension plan that allows and encourages investment opportunities that result in comfortable pensions based on exceptional returns on an investment portfolio. If the administrative flaws did not exist, employees could have these comfortable pensions based on the extraordinary earnings of the PERS investment rather than cost of higher taxes at the local government level. We appreciate this opportunity to share this information with you.
thank you very much for coming here.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. We've worked together for the past 6 to 8 months with the League of Oregon Cities together trying to address the impact of the unfunded liabilities which showed up on the accounts of the counties and the cities. And we are here today to support Senate Bill 722. The commissioners have kept close track of the bills, have kept close track of the analysis, and involved themselves in different ways in which we might try to correct the flaws that are in the PERS retirement system and still retain a good quality retirement system. I think the work that's been done is excellent work and will get us a long way down that path. I won't add much. I echo most of the comments that Mayor Corvallis has made. It's just to say that we thank the PERS board, the PERS staff, many people who have worked long and hard to try to find some answers here that will be very important to the county. The impact of the rate increases is just significant on many of the counties, and something needed to be done to try and change those structural flaws and systems. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
My testimony is being passed out. There's two pieces to it. One page that supports Senate Bill 722, outlining the help with the structural and operational biases in the PERS system that Senate Bill 722 provides. I would like to highlight one point in that we are working with bond counsel on an amendment for the section that deals with authorizing local governments to finance their unfunded PERS liabilities through a bonding section. I've got a draft, and the bond council is reviewing that, and I'll have that to you hopefully later today. We do ask for your vote in support of Senate Bill 722, and I'd be happy to answer questions if you'd like.
This is Deborah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're currently the present League of Oregon Cities Director.
No, I work for the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties.
Okay. In discussions that you've had, how real is the possibility that more than a few cities may opt out of PERS? Or the salmon from the Association of Counties, how real is that possibility?
Yeah, I don't have a way to really to calculate that. Where I know what they feel is if they see this show up again, they would certainly opt out of PERS. They can't afford what they're faced with right now. If this is a significant long-term fix, then I think you would see them stay in and the chance of opting out would be much smaller. I think their preference would be to stay in the system so long as it doesn't get out of hand like it is right now in terms of their ability to afford it.
The party doesn't. You know, this bill was just referred to this committee, so we haven't had really an opportunity to review it entirely, and I know that we're not going to act on it today, and hopefully we'll have a few days to digest the bill. But if you opted out, I'll have to look at the bill itself. Wouldn't you have an obligation potentially to retirees? I know you will have already paid in on an actuarial basis, but if that is actuarial basis, ultimately is determined not to be adequate, even if you opted out, couldn't you have some obligation for future benefits for retirees?
Chair Simmons and Representative Devlin, the language is written in that it would be future hires that would not go into PERS, and the obligation to the people that are already in PERS, whether they've retired or not, would remain with the local government. So the obligation of those already in and their benefits would be continued. The opt-out is only for future hires. It's not to take current people out of the system.
Final question, Ms. Chairman. there was this concern expressed when we went to a two-tiered system, and now we're talking about a three-tiered system, and potentially a three-tiered system with some employees also being in a fourth tier, which would be opted out under some new system. And the basic fear was, is the situation it would create in terms of how employees would view their positions. I mean, if I'm doing this job and my package of benefits are A, and the person next to me is doing the same job and their package benefits are B, and their package is significantly greater than mine, do you see that causing a problem at the city or county level?
On the first, Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, on the first part of the question in terms of Tier 3, the reason that we need a Tier 3 is that we cannot uncouple the alternative benefit calculations that are in the current Tier 1 and Tier 2. Those can't be changed in Tier 1 and Tier 2 because of contract rights, where we've got a hybrid mixture that's unique, where there's a sort of a defined benefit and a defined contribution, and the employee gets whichever gives them the highest amount, which causes conflicting funding methods and creates a problem. That's why we need the Tier 3. To the second part of your question, in terms of employees working side by side with maybe different total benefit packages, it could create a problem in some places or in some situations. We currently have employees working side by side with different benefit packages. They're hired in, their wages are different for doing similar jobs. PERS has had a 1% pension plus annuity benefit that's only available to those who've worked before 1981. So basically from 81 forward, we had two tiers before we got to what we're calling the second tier. So we don't see that as an insurmountable problem.
Mr. Chairman, I only brought it up because if you did have a governmental entity that acted out and they operated for some time under a newly approved Tier 3, and you're saying that there is a slight difference, included an actual Tier 1 before even we had two tiers before we even identified it as having two tiers, then you'll have those pre-1981 people, the Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, and any new employees that are covered under a new plan. It sounds to be a little bit confusing on the surface, if not in reality confusing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, one other point that I wanted to make is that we currently have some cities and counties that never got into PERS that have their own local pension plan. So the fact that other cities and counties could have their own local pension plan is not something that's brand new.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment, the city of Tualatin in the mid-1980s was early 1980s was non-PERS and then became PERS. And it became PERS largely because it could not compete with other public employers and was losing their employees because their employees saw much better retirement benefits for other public employers, so that's why they came into PERS.
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, I would add that there are other states where there are different tiers of retirement, and it seems to be working for them. So this is not a new experiment in Oregon either.
Representative Gardner.
I'm more interested in the opt-out portion. If you opt out with your new hired employees beyond the specific date, what are the requirements for what you have to provide for those employees as far as the retirement system and local government?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, under the current law, those employees, PERS or local governments that did not join PERS do not have any statutory requirements on the benefit for pension plans, and those who would opt out of PERS under this bill would not have statutory requirements on the benefits that would be offered. They would have market competition requirements in terms of being able to attract and retain employees.
So, I mean, follow up on that. Yes, Chair. Basically, you're saying is if you opt out for that portion for new hires, there'd be no statutory requirement whatsoever. You could provide a retirement or not.
Representative Simmons and Chair Simmons and Representative Gardner, that's correct.
One other question on the, assuming you do an opt-out, assuming you do provide a system, doesn't that dramatically affect portability if we're going to go from one city that's opted out, one that hasn't, between different municipalities as far as portability?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, I would defer that question to PERS. I think that you can move into PERS in terms of portability, but they're here, and I'd ask you if you'd ask that question.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, you want to comment?
I would like to, if that is in order. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do not think there is any public entity, employer, that is eagerly awaiting the opportunity to opt out. I think the reason that this issue has come forward is that you need to realize that we have had a terrible financial shock. And when that happens in any organization, you think in terms of how you can protect your organization against a similar shock in the future. These changes that Senate Bill 722 would make are the essential ones. And they have been developed with an eye to the long-term future, to the correction of these structural flaws in a way that will last. And in the long run, of course, that's very much the benefit of both employers and employees. So I think getting a little uncomfortable with the discussion here, which seems to imply that public employers would very readily opt out. I don't think so, and I think with this new system, with these flaws taken care of, and with the Tier 3 looking into the future, that opting out, in my opinion, would be not particularly attractive.
Follow-up question at all?
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Rainey? Please introduce yourself to the record as soon as you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Ramig. I'm with the Lindsay Hart firm in Portland, and I'm here today representing the Variable Annuity Life Insurance Company, which is one of the larger providers of alternative retirement plans in the nation. They were earlier, Mr. Kearns referred to them as a provider under the alternative retirement plan authorized for the state university system. Likewise, our client provides alternative plans for employees of the Oregon Health Sciences University. I'm going to be real brief in my comments today. I'm here to support principally the opt-out provisions of Senate Bill 722, which have been a subject of considerable discussion today, and largely because they provide a source of rate certainty for local government. I really want to just make three points. One, in addressing any changes of the scope involved in Senate Bill 22, policymakers should be concerned about the impact on the existing retirement system. Because of that, our client had prepared by Aon Consulting, which is one of the worldwide leaders in employee benefits, an analysis of the potential impact of the opt-out provisions on the existing PERS system, and I provided a copy of that for each member of the committee and have additional copies available. The second point I wanted to make, I believe, was raised, Mr. Chair, by Representative Gardner,
with relation to portability. One of the major problems with portability right now for employees in PERS is that they go outside of PERS, for example, to a nonprofit sector employer or into the private sector. Their pension is not portable. Likewise, a employee in a local jurisdiction who transfers to a jurisdiction like Representative Devlin mentioned, Tualatin, used to not be in PERS. If they transfer to one of those jurisdictions that's not in PERS, likewise, there presently isn't accountability or isn't portability for their pension. So while a jurisdiction opting out of PERS can create pension portability issues, I think the net effect of the bill would actually be to enhance portability. And I know from the conversations I've had with PERS, they've looked at options for allowing inward portability to the PERS system. So if someone has a non-PERS pension, they can roll it into the PERS system. So again, it's an issue, but it's one that should be able to be addressed. As far as what cities and counties may or might not do, I would just offer this comment. I really view the opt-out language as a safeguard for cities and counties who, my father's the mayor of Pendleton, and I know they're actually cutting positions in Pendleton to fund the retirement benefits under the PERS system right now. And I think the whole momentum behind this bill is jurisdictions that have to make the hard decisions every day wanting additional options when their backs are forced to the wall with costs that have gotten out of control. And what the opt-out language does is allows people really to be a consumer instead of having a monopoly over retirement planning services. It would give local jurisdictions choice, and if they feel like they can get a better option by going outside of PERS, they'd be authorized to do so. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
I have a question for you. If there is a third tier and we reenact this legislation, Helen Bird indicated that the mayor of Corvallis indicated that it would not be very attractive to opt out. Mm-hmm. That tells me that the youth retirement programs that are offered by companies such as yours would not appear very attractive in comparison to a third tier of PERS. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it all depends upon the goals of the employer. One of the advantages of opting out of PERS is you create absolute certainty, assuming you adopt a defined contribution plan, as to what your costs are. So if certainty is the highest value, you go that way. Another concern a number of local jurisdictions have is recruiting qualified people to the employees at the city. And again, by having a defined contribution plan, like Mr. Karen spoke to as to the university system, that's often a very valuable tool from a recruitment standpoint. There are a number of other advantages of alternative plans, just like there are advantages of PERS. It's not like one is necessarily better than the other per se. They have different benefits depending on the perspective of the person making the choice.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to call now Fred McDonald from PERS, who the Senate has neutral, will give us more information here, and then we will call those in opposition.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Fred McDonald, the director of PERS, and with me is Mark Johnson, our consulting actuary from the firm of Milliman and Robertson, who has been our consulting actuary since the year 1975. Not Mark all those years necessarily, but the firm. I would like to rather briefly, Mr. Chairman, indicate to the committee what the PERS position is on the various components, the various sections of the bill that you are considering. We have had numerous discussions with the PERS board with regard to these items, and I will summarize their position for you. The first one being the Tier 3 benefit calculation, which is very similar to one of the methods that we have to calculate benefits now that Ms. Keltner mentioned, the so-called pension plus annuity. It is very similar to that. However, that became only for employees prior to 1981 also, as she mentioned. So it's kind of a last person's club at the moment that would reinstate that as part of our plan. In fact, it would be the only plan for new employees. The PERS board typically has remained neutral on issues such as this, that issues that involve either enhancements to benefits or decreases in benefits. And they feel that this is a legislative policy decision, and so basically that is their position. That is,
almost all agencies felt that way.
Well, we have, actually, Mr. Chairman, there are some legislators who have indicated the opposite of that. They wish that our PERS board at times would take a more definite position. So, anyhow. But they feel this is not this is a majority, not there are, certainly are others on our board who don't feel that way. But I will take that comment back to them, because those who are in the majority will appreciate hearing it. The lump sum withdrawal of employer contributions is a new concept that's included in the bill. We have part of that in our system now, where an employee can do a lump sum payment of their account balance when they retire. That has been a part of our system all along. What this does is adds the employer portion, a matching amount for Tier 1 and Tier 2 people, that they can take the employer money at retirement and roll it over in, or whatever they might choose to do with it. The motive behind this is that the retiree has the ability to get his or her hands on the funds immediately for whatever purpose they choose to use. That can be a disadvantage, but anyhow, some feel it would be an advantage. But it also saves the system the cost of COLAs as the years go by, the annual increase that the system provides, which is normally 2%, the cost of living allowance. So it saves us the cost of COLAs. The pooling of local government employers. This, especially in light of testimony that you've heard, is one of the most important parts of this bill, in our opinion. Local governments are not pooled now with regard to the calculation of their contribution rates. And as you've heard, for many of those local governments, contribution rates have skyrocketed in the last two year valuation performed by our actuary. The state, however, and the schools are pooled in that every state agency, all of their gains and losses to the system, if they experience losses, liabilities, maybe a lot of people retire, maybe a lot of people go out on disabilities, maybe one agency has an abnormal amount of police and fire people who are more expensive, then their liabilities, much like a health insurance risk pool, are pooled with all of the state agencies, so it smooths the liabilities that are incurred, and it also smooths the gains. And as a result, the state's contribution rate this last valuation period went up by about the same amount that the House Bill 3349 from the 97 session, the tax remedy for PERS retirees, it went up only because of that. They did not, because primarily of the smoothing process, experience an increase like the local governments have. And the same as, in fact, the state's rate would have gone down had it not been for 3349. The schools would have been about the same had it not been for 3349. So it speaks to the importance of pooling. And the local governments need to pool, those who choose to stay in the system. They need to pool. And in fact, several years ago, my predecessor tried to convince the local government group that they should pool, that they should consider pooling, for this exact reason, because they are more subject to the volatility of liabilities that are incurred. And certainly, as we all know, there have been some liabilities in the last 2 years incurred. And Mark has a number that I would like him to mention to you that had local governments been pooled during this period, their contribution rate as a whole would have gone up by
about 1% of pay.
Introduce yourself to the record.
Mark Johnson, actuary with Milliman and Robertson, on a contract with the State Retirement Board. I think the comment about pooling is that pooling in itself isn't saving any money in total. What it's doing is providing more stability, so that while some entities may enjoy a gain in 1 year, while others have losses, those would be shared so that there would be a more stable rate. The rate in the last 2 years for most employers went up pretty dramatically. The biggest part of that was due to the tax remedies, but some employers, particularly some of the larger ones, had some extraordinary increases, as mentioned by the mayor of Corvallis, not to be denied. By pooling the rates, there would be much less volatility. And I think volatility is the one thing that local employers try to avoid. I mean, as was also mentioned by the previous testimony about looking for stability, if you know what your contributions are, pooling local agencies into one actuarial group will help that. Now, I might point out that there will be a distinction between general service employees and police and fire, because police and fire are more expensive, so we're not going to charge a water district the same rate you charge a fire district. So there is a differential that needs to be made there. But other than that, as Fred mentioned, the pooling of future gains and losses it will be an extraordinary step for more stability in local employee rates.
Mr. Chairman, this
is a microphone for each of you.
This would not do away with present unfunded liabilities that each one of the local employers has.
It's prospective thing.
Prospective, that's right. But I think it's time. The objection, of course, is there are some local governments whose rates would go up. There are some whose rates would go down. And the ones that the reason for opposition would be from those whose rates would go up. We understand that, but for the good of the group, I don't think there's much question that this needs to be done. The next one, the section 17 and 18 of the bill have to do with employer participation in the so-called variable annuity account investments. And I'm going to spare you the details unless you'd like to go into it now, but basically what it means is that employer dollars would be able to be invested in the same manner that employees' variable dollars are invested. And present time, that's not the case. It needs to be done. It needs to be corrected. The withdrawal option for local governments, the so-called opt-out, which sections 19 and 20, if local governments stay in their unpooled situation, they don't pool, then it's not necessarily a disaster for PERS to have the local governments withdraw. They would still have their liabilities, as had been asked earlier by one of the committee members, I believe Representative Gardner. Those liabilities would stay with them. They would have to be paid. And it really wouldn't affect anybody else. However, if local governments pool, which I've made a case for them to do so, then opting out would not be in the best interest of the pool, I think, for obvious reasons. So for that reason, we are in opposition to the opt-out feature in this bill. Sections 21 and 22 have to do with crediting of earnings to employers at time of retirement. This is something that should be done, and we therefore are in total support of that. The bonding of local government, which is the next in sections 23 and 24, and I understand there are some amendments. Our full board's not had the opportunity to consider it, but our committee of the board has that deals with legislation and certainly would support that provision to whomever it might be offered. And that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If there are any questions, I'd be pleased to try to answer them. Or Mark.
Representative Gardner?
Yeah, I asked a question earlier about portability if they have an opt-out. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, I would like to speak to that. I think one of the true advantages of a consolidated system, which PERS is, has local governments, schools, and state, is that people can move from one employer to the other and stay in the same retirement system. Their money stays with them. And that's what portability is all about. Now, in the higher ed example for an optional retirement plan that was approved two sessions ago, we felt because higher ed had some unique needs and that we were not able to bring retirement system assets in from other systems out of state and or move out from ours to other systems out of state, that certainly that was in the best interest of higher ed to have that portability feature. I think, though, Representative Gardner, that definitely would be a factor from local government to local government. If they're not in one retirement system, then certainly the portability wouldn't be quite as readily available as it would be if they were all in the same system. However, they would still maintain the assets from each system. I mean, when somebody leaves our system and goes out of state, their assets stay in our system, and they're eligible to get them when they retire. So that would still exist.
Yeah, that's very much like people in the private sector do currently.
Yeah.
They use your assets there, and they continue to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes time to retire, they're available to you.
That's correct. There are some things moving on the federal congressional area, Representative Gardner, that would even more so add to portability features. It's a big issue presently. More portability seems to be something that everybody really wants for people to prepare for their assets for retirement.
Representative Devlin.
Another question. Assuming the bill passes and local governments are pooled, what happens to the rates for the remaining employers if you have a number of significant local governments opt out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, the state...
Let me back that up. All local governments are significant. I'm talking about numbers in total.
Larger ones.
Appreciate that.
Okay.
The bill calls for the retirement system to establish an administrative rule regarding pooling. We have already given our thoughts to the retirement board about how such pooling should take place. With respect to an opt-out after pooling, and we've not given our thoughts to the retirement board, but I would just say this. There is a way to isolate the liabilities of a city or a county or a special district that is going to opt out even after pooling takes place. It's much more complicated, obviously, than if that employer is rated by itself. But I think that from our discussions with the retirement board, one of the overriding criteria is that the liabilities, particularly those that have accrued so far, would not be shared. They would not be pooled. In other words, every employer is subject to the liabilities that have accrued up to the day when we start pooling. And I would suggest that our recommendation would be that if an employer were to opt out, that they could not opt out of their obligation, so to speak, from the employees that were there. So I don't see that as being a particular problem. It would be much more complicated than it is now, but I would suggest that we would try to perform the calculations to insulate other employers from that process. Again, be open, a board rule with meetings or input from all employers. So we would hope that through that process we would be able to cover all the bases.
Mr. Gardner?
I just want to ask a question about the sick leave portion. What would it cost? You have any idea what it costs local governments if employees use up their sick leave more often than actually using the option of saving it for retirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I really don't know the utilization factor because of sick leave having been included in the retirement. I know that I'm certain that people, when they know they can add their sick leave, unused accrued sick leave, that certainly it makes them judiciously use their sick leave. I think we see that more so in schools probably than we do elsewhere because it costs schools to have substitute teachers come in when a person's sick. and that was one of the reasons that sick leave was added to the benefit calculation in the full formula, not the money match. It's not used in the money match, and the Tier 3, proposed Tier 3, does not include sick leave either. So it is a factor, but I don't know really how much. I don't know if Zach has some more comments.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, over 95% of the current liabilities are projected to be delivered through the money match calculation. Mm-hmm. The money match calculation is unaffected by unused sick leave. So when you say what impact does it have, it has a very, very small impact on the system right now. Most of the benefits that are being delivered in the other methods, that is the full formula and so forth, are for police and fire, where sick leave would come into play. But for, like I said, over 95% of the liabilities, the sick leave just does not come into play. And I think that's one of the reasons we were questioned about this on the Senate side. The Senate, I think, was looking for consistency. The sick leave is, even though it's in the statute now, it's not really being utilized for Tier 1 and probably won't be for Tier 2 because of the money match. And that was a consistency issue, as I recall, for Tier 3. It also saved approximately 0.4% of pay or something of that nature on the Tier 3 bill. It's a factor on Tier 3 because Tier 3 is a pension plus annuity, and that pension piece that the employer is providing is a strictly defined benefit. And there, unused sick leave would be a factor. So from the employer perspective on Tier 3, it was a major issue because it would have a significant cost impact. So we're saving more now under the amended 722 now that sick leave has been taken out. Does that answer your question?
Not exactly, but it will cost, if by taking it out, it will cost local government a lot more people using it up more.
Well, that could be, but that, I don't think that's any, my point is that, I don't think that's any different than today, because unused sick leave isn't impacting current retirees, other than perhaps a police and fire or somebody that had a very dramatic promotion or escalation in pay in the last 3 years is where the full formula would come into play. But most of the people who are retiring now are money managed, and it just doesn't come into play.
This is Devlin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. When you talk to local governments about the increases they've experienced, they blame them primarily on probably two or three different factors. One is the temporary fix to the issue of taxability of PERS benefits. It was done by the 95 sessions. The match that has to be provided to the money match employees. The fact that those employees may have retired earlier than anticipated or actuarially anticipated, given the fact that the market was so good, their investments were so good that they retired earlier than they thought that they would. Well, what is the connection between those? I can see the connection between some of the items that are in the bill. But what's the connection between those and having a third tier or allowing the local government to opt out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, the connection, you mentioned the tax issue. There's no connection. There's no connection between Senate Bill 722 and the tax liability that was brought onto our system by the 1995 legislature in the way that the legislature determined that retirees should be paid back. They put it on the backs of the employers. I mean, pure and simple. The backs of the local governments and the schools and the state also had to pay its share. Out of a $2.3 billion liability that our system has right now, $1.5 is from the tax. And this has nothing to do with that. However, the last 2 years have also seen the phenomenon occur of the money match. And that's a method that we use to calculate benefits. And this bill would do away with the money match.
For the Tier 3.
For the Tier 3, over the next 30 years. It's not immediate. 30 years being a life of a career employee.
But then, Mr. Chairman, then isn't the opt-out just a
has no real connection. It's just somebody saying that if this gets any worse,
the opt-out,
you've got an ability to get out of the system.
No, and I think that's a correct assessment, Representative Devlin. Right, and I think some of the local government representatives have probably answered that better than I can.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
Mr. Devlin. You've taken no position on a third tier. In fact, you had some discussion of that earlier. Without taking a position, what do you think are the pluses and negatives of a third tier?
Mr. Chairman,
for an analysis, not
Representative, I would be pleased to offer what my thoughts are in that regard, and I'm sure Mark would have some too. The pluses, the pension plus annuity is not a bad plan. I mean, we've had it. It's produced reasonable benefits in the past. Now this is scaled down somewhat because it doesn't include sick leave. And it does, over a long period of time, address the money match method that we have to calculate benefits. Now, I'm going through what you asked me, advantages to the Tier 3, and I haven't yet covered the disadvantages, but those would be the major ones as I see it, the money match. But, you know, there could be slight adjustments maybe made to the money match. And accomplish the same thing. This is not the only way to accomplish it. It is one way to accomplish it. As far as the disadvantages, I think that as long as costs can be contained to a reasonable level, our objective, and a good objective, I feel, is that we should try to achieve the highest benefit level that we can for our members. But with that proviso that costs have to be contained. And certainly the money match provides an excellent level of benefits, assuming that market conditions are good. Now, if we were sitting here today and market conditions had not been good, we might have the same problems with regard to employer contribution rates, but we wouldn't have high benefits. I mean, there's some risk that's being taken by our members as well as by the employers. But had the market conditions not been good, we would have not been in a money match situation. We would have been in the defined benefit where employers have to guarantee a certain level of benefit. That's the formula, final average salary times a factor times number of years of service, and that provides the foundation level benefit. Certainly the money match has helped attract and recruit people into government service. I don't think there's any question about that. And I don't think the Tier 3 is going to do an effective job in that regard. But on the other hand, costs have to be considered too. I mean, we could have the most elegant retirement system in the country, but if the costs are not contained, then it all of a sudden becomes not so elegant. So it's a real tightrope that must be walked. But The disadvantage would be recruitment and the fact that it's not an immediate fix. It's a long-term kind of a situation. We won't see immediate advantages from a third tier. 5 years, it'll start 10 years. And, in fact, with the Tier 2, we projected that the savings would be more than what they'd actually turned out. And that's probably because of the money match phenomenon that's occurred in the last year. Who would have ever thought we would have the investment years that we've had in the last 2 years. I mean, our investment returns have been outstanding, and that's what's thrown this money match into a tilt.
Let's go for a moment to this bonding of local government unfunded PERS liabilities. How large are some of those unfunded liabilities currently? And we're borrowing to pay for retirement here. It seems like
instead of financing the payment of those unfunded liabilities through PERS, Mr. Chairman, it would be financing it through the bonding, and at a presumably a lower rate. And the Treasury is the group that's been looking into this, and so they're the experts on it, but we can certainly address the magnitude of the unfunded liabilities.
And aside, you've got to figure out how to do this for your private retirement. let me know.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, if you figure out a way that you can do that for your personal private retirement, borrow money to pay for it, let me know. So go ahead.
Okay.
Senator Simmons, the liabilities for local agencies, unfunded liabilities in question is about $800 million. And, of course, the key here is the interest rate environment. Employers are having their liabilities discounted at 8% in the system. And that's what the portfolio is expected to earn over a very long period of time. So that's how they are charged, if you will, for the time value of money. To the extent that an employer can go out and borrow the same amount of money at a lower interest rate, the arbitrage is a savings to the employer. So what will happen is that we just did this at the City of Oakland, California, 2 years ago. They put $400 million, went up or down with $400 million in, and then they had these 2 years of good investment earnings, so they're dramatically in a better position. So it's an investment decision. I think it's a good opportunity for local employers to provide assets to PERS to get rid of the unfunded liability and pay it off at a much lower interest rate.
How large are some of these outstanding liabilities?
Well, of course, it depends on the size of the employer, too. Some of the counties have a lot of employees. For example, Clackamas County, $16 million. Douglas County, $8 million. Lane County, $40 million. Multnomah County, $158 million. Those are the largest counties. If you go down, can be significant. Tens of millions of dollars for some of the larger employers.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? I'm going to hand the gavel off. I've got a meeting I've got to run up to the majority leader's office just for a few minutes. I'll tell you about Daniel. So, this is the answer.
There are several, Mr. Chairman, that have surpluses as well. Not all have unfunded liabilities. Mm-hmm.
I have one basic question, and it's sort of very basic. If you look at some of these provisions, some of them seem relatively simple, straightforward, and there's agreement on them. The two provisions that we're hearing the most about and are in the governor's letter are the opt-out provision and the possibility of creating a third tier. In your experience in the system, do you think that if we made those kinds of changes, that it would be better to, since we're trying to make changes to fix the system for a long period of time, that we take a greater time studying what those changes should be before we make them and looking at all the ramifications? I mean, we seem to be eager to make changes in the final closing weeks of the session. This committee's had this bill in front of it for one and a half hour hearing. How would you think it'd be best for us to approach major changes to the system?
Mr. Chairman, it's a deep, complex subject. It doesn't get the time that's justified in two afternoons of hearings, in my opinion. It, however, has been discussed at length in numerous forums and venues. But I would say probably the best way would be to have, for example, this is just an off-the-top thought, but an interim committee that would have a year to look at this and come back to the next legislative session with proposals that are the result of a thorough analysis. Actuarial analysis, benefits analysis, personnel, human resources type of analysis. As I say, that's just a thought. But, and frankly, it's also disturbing that not everybody's here, because everybody should be here to hear this bill. This is an important bill. And it's just too bad that not everybody's here.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call some people up in groups. Start off with
I'm kind of selecting. Everybody will get a chance to speak, but I'm trying to select groups. So could Rich Pepper, Tricia Bozak, and Mary Botkin come forward?
Rich was on sick.
Oh, okay. Oh, how about Tricia?
Yeah, he was sick. Okay.
And Tricia Smith?
No more news. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I actually have written testimony. You should be very impressed. I'm not always this efficient, but I don't want to read my testimony. What I want to do is just talk to you a little bit and kind of walk through, rather than kind of start out saying we hate this bill and we want you to kill it. I think what we need to do is start by saying that you've gotten, today you received the Dash 10 amendment, which really do kind of capitalize in amendment form the issues that we're supporting. And I'd like to walk through very quickly those pieces of the bill that we support. We support the interest earnings crediting and the changing of the timing of that crediting so that the employer and the employee both get their accounts credited at the same time. And just quickly, so you know, that saves, that if that had been in place, that would have saved the employers and will save the employers about $81 million, or it would have been in terms of their rate, it would have been a 0.46 reduction in their rate. We support the double lump sum withdrawal. You know, we have to make some assumptions, and so we made the assumption that about 15% of the employees would take advantage of the double lump sum withdrawal of funds. Now, if it goes higher, the savings would be higher, but that would save the employers at that level about $26 million or another 0.46 reduction in their rate. We have long supported the option of allowing the employers to participate in the variable account. We think it makes sense. And I do want to tell the committee, just for the record, that it was never the employees nor their representatives that suggested that employers should not be in the variable. It was the employers themselves. And we support local government pooling. We're strong advocates of that. We just heard from HERS that had the pooling been in effect and all of the things that happened, that have happened up to this point, the local government rate increase would have been about 1%. That should tell us something about how valuable the pooling option is. Now, there's been a lot of questions before the committee, and I have to tell you, that's where our support stops. Well, except for the bonding. I mean, the bonding makes an incredible amount of sense. But I want to talk about unfunded liabilities a little bit separately than the other issues. Because I think unfunded liabilities deserve kind of a separate discussion. We have a real problem with the idea of kind of putting together a third chair or allowing local governments to opt out. We don't think that most of our employers would accept or choose the opt-out proposal, but we do think that there are employers who will. You know, to be quite honest with you, I'm not worried about the city of Corvallis opting out. That's one of our employers. I'm not worried about the city of Pendleton opting out. That's another one of our employers. You know, we have Umatilla County. We have people all over the state, as you all know. And we have them in rural and urban and southern and northern and in the valley and out of the valley and in the mid, you know. We have them everywhere. And we don't think most of them will opt out of PERS. But if even one of them opts out of PERS now, we can't even begin to fathom what the bargaining structure will look like when you're trying to bargain a contract that allows half the employees out of PERS, some of them are in PERS. I mean, I don't know what that structure looks like, and if they decide to opt out, how we construct the manner for them to opt out. And I want to say that one of the problems, and this goes back to the unfunded liability, one of the problems with opting out is that if they decide to opt back in, or if there's a consolidation where non-PERS employers come in and move into and consolidate with PERS employers, we end up with an untenable situation like we've had in the Tri-County area where some of our folks have moved into the city of Portland or where Multnomah County moved and changed and went to be a PERS employer, and all the unfunded liability that they accepted at that point, and how do we pay for that, and how do we provide for smooth transitions and consolidations or transfer services if you've got some PERS employers and some non-PERS employers, and who pays for the unfunded liability, and how do we keep it separate? And now all of a sudden we've got a pooled rate, so now we're going to consolidate non-PERS with PERS. I mean, we agree, PERS, you can't have pooling and opt-out. You just can't do it. It doesn't work. And, you know, we think government needs the flexibility to expand and contract where it makes sense and when it makes sense to offer efficiencies to the taxpayers. The sick leave issue is, this is another one of those issues that, you know, maybe someday they'll pass term on this for lobbyists so none of us will remember what happened. I was here when the sick leave became an issue and local governments and government employers came in and said, oh my God, we need to get rid of this sick leave cost. And, you know, we're losing our employees at the end of their careers. And, you know, the last 90 days of their career, they're burning up their sick leave and we're having these terrible transitions from long-term professional classes of people who are retiring and we're trying to replace them and they're not around to train their replacements. And so what can we do? What can we do? I have to tell you, I was vehemently, vehemently opposed to the use of sick leave in retirement. And, you know, I'd like to say that the Republicans ran over me, but it wasn't them, it was the Democrats. You know, I have footprints permanently embedded where they said, you know, you need to just get out of our way on this, because they linked up with our employers and said, no, we're going to take the sick leave and we're going to give you a different option. And, oh, by the way, you only get half of it. But we're going to give you half of it towards your retirement to increase your retirement benefits and in exchange for you sticking around till the very last day. And we thought that was absolutely a unilateral implementation of something that we should be able to bargain over about how we use sick leave. And the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, decided that we didn't need to do that, that they were just going to do this because it was the best thing to do. It made good business sense, I think, was what they said at the time. And they did it. And now we want to undo it. Well, you know, I don't really care whether you do it or undo it, but let's create a system and keep it that way. Because what you have now is you have employees who really don't use their sick leave, even when they should at times. I mean, we think that they ought to stay home sick when they're sick, and there are times when they don't. But I'd like to see it, you know, kind of established one way or the other so people know what they're doing and can make plans appropriately. And then finally, I just want to make a pitch for going a little slower. I think that we should amend the bill. I think we should do those things that fix the problems, that give employers immediate relief. I think that that is critical. We are not unsympathetic to the problems that our employers are facing. We are not, we're not naive enough to believe that we can have these kinds of rate increases and continue to bargain wage increases and benefit increases in other areas. We think that there is certainly a glitch, if not a problem. And I am concerned that we're not exactly sure why the glitch happened to begin with. And I have employers telling me that they got wrong numbers, that they were given bad advice, mean, I can't even begin to scrape the surface if that's true or not. At this point, it's just anecdotal stories. And I'm very interested in long-term fixes if there was a problem. But I think we need some time to make sure that there really was a problem and not try to find solutions for a problem we have not finished to identify and define. And I just encourage us to do the four or five things and give them immediate relief and then move on and try and set up some kind of an interim task force or committee or something that puts us in the room together. I don't think this is an us and them. I think this is a us and us, and it ought to be handled that way. And I don't think it's the legislature versus the unions versus the employers. I think we all ought to pool our resources and our intelligence and find solutions. Thank you. This is like a reduced
Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents 17,000 classified school employees in Oregon's K-12 district, community colleges, ESDs, Park and Rec district, and now Oregon, Lane County, Oregon Head Start. And I'd like to begin by telling you that as a member of the PERS Coalition, OSEA agrees with the testimony that some of you just heard from Ms. Bodkin, and say that and stress that we have been working all session long to try to move forward solutions to the problems that certain local governments, a handful of local governments in the whole mix of governments involved in CERS, have experienced. And we support the portions of Senate Bill 722 which address those problems directly and effectively. Those portions are those which Ms. Botkin outlined for you, and essentially in the shorter version are everything but the third tier for new hires and the opt-out provision for local government. Everything else in this bill is important and should be passed discretion. We believe that government employers, like many of the rest of us who are not in Tahiti right now, enjoying the benefits of our foresight, did not anticipate what's happened in the stock market. But what's happened has happened. Establishing a third tier won't change what's happened. It won't change the responsibility of PERS employers to meet their obligations under the law for existing employees. A third tier will not change that at all. If the argument for a third tier is to prevent it from happening for future employees, I would suggest to you that allowing employers into the variable as they now wish accomplishes that without penalizing new employees. So it's unnecessary from that standpoint. We can find no reason to establish a third tier if the interest in this bill is to assist local government employers dealing with unanticipated high ratings. If the purpose of a third tier is to penalize employees, it would do that. Some of the ways that it would, you've discussed here through the answers and questions that you had of other witnesses. For example, for my union, and I would like, if it's possible, for you to try to focus on OSEA members while I speak, so that you get a different picture of them than, say, the superintendent of Colonel Kaiser School District, who has a different situation than OSEA members. OSEA members are the bus drivers and the custodians and the cooks and the secretaries and the educational assistants in school. Nearly 50% of them make less than $15,000 a year. For a family of four, that's below the federal poverty level. 57.8% of them make less than $1,500 a month.
try raising a family on it. The reason, one of the main reasons that people come to work as a classified employee in school and stay there is their PERS retirement. It's why they stay. They might come because their kids are in that school and they want to work close to their kids. But they stay because they have a retirement benefit. Their salary may not be equal to what they could make on the, in the private sector, but they have a retirement benefit. That's something that they don't have anywhere else. They'll still have a retirement benefit under the third tier. So when you're making $1,500 a month, the astronomical returns that you're going to see through PERS aren't a lot. And you will still have difficulty supporting yourself in your retirement years. And if you can't, let me remind you who does. That will be you. You will be supporting my members in their retirement years if they can't support themselves through their PERS. Any questions? I'm not quite there. Okay. Close, though. Try to visualize in your mind, if you can, sitting in a 60-foot metal box with 75 yelling kids for 30 years. Now, I think that's a big thing to ask somebody to do. I was very pleased that the corporal punishment bill didn't pass with the provisions that would have allowed my school bus drivers to spank kids because they're ready. And I don't blame them. Being in a metal box for 30 years with 75 kids, that's a big deal. After being in that metal box for 35 years with all those kids, a decent retirement benefit that will allow you to make your house payments and pay for your food and your health care is not an unreasonable expectation. It's very difficult to keep people in classified positions in school. The turnover rate is high. The reason that they stay now is PERS. It will be difficult for employers to be able to count on people showing up to drive those kids to school every day without that. The last point I'd like to make is with regards to the opt-out provision within this bill. This doesn't affect schools. It only affects local employers. But I would suggest to you that since this provision does not require local employers to replace PERS if they opt out for new hires, it is entirely possible, and you should consider, that certain future public employees, those working for local governments, may have no retirement because the local government would like to do it, but just simply can't afford it. To set up a system where public employees in today's day and age, when we see retirement savings in crisis all over the country, to set up a system that allows public employers to provide no retirement is short-sighted, and I would suggest that it is the wrong thing to do. I hope this committee will remove these two provisions from this bill because we will enthusiastically support it if that occurs, because we do believe the other provisions need to be adopted. And thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak representing the Oregon Education Association, 43,000 members across the state, both classified and certified employees. I'm here today to voice our opposition to Senate Bill 722 as it came from the Senate. Our interest in the bill, like the two previous witnesses, our interest in the bill is genuine because of the articulated problems from local governments about the rate increases. We believe they're real. While they haven't impacted school districts maybe to the extent that they have other local governments, it's still an impact there, and so that's what gives us our interest in the bill. We feel like it's appropriate to examine the system and look at solutions to these problems, but we feel like that Senate Bill 722 goes a bit too far. We would support the A-10 amendments, which have, I think, the agreed-upon group of fixes to the system that would provide what employers say they need most, and that's immediate relief from rate increases. And we believe that those things will do it at the tune of approximately $120 million a year. I think Mary outlined previously what some of those costs were on those. So we do support that. Again, our opposition, too, is to the two provisions that are not in the A-10 amendments but are in Senate Bill 722, and that's the opt-out and the third tier. We feel like the opt-out provisions that will stifle portability, and we question whether employers will have the ability to provide, if they do provide, retirement systems that can equal or come close to doing what a large retirement system can do in bringing those kind of benefits. The third tier concerns us for a number of reasons. I think you'll hear more about this later from some of the public safety people, but the PERS goal for a retiree is to have make between 75 and 85% of their pre-retirement income. And the pension plus annuity option that is in tier three in this bill doesn't come close to that. For general service members, which are the members that I represent, I think it's estimated that they would come close from between 46 and 58%. This PERS goal includes not only PERS, but also their Social Security benefits. For public safety, police and fire, it's somewhat lower than that, between 47 and 53%. And you will hear more about this from them, but the so-called gap problem between what happens when someone retires at age, between age 52 and 58, and when they can actually draw Social Security. They will have this reduced part of, be receiving this reduced amount of their retirement benefit. And we see that as a very big concern, what happens with those people. Right now, PERS, I think, is estimated that 57% of members retire at 50% or less of their final average salary. So some of the celebrated cases that so much has been made of those people retiring rich off their PERS retirement, we feel like is overblown and a little out of proportion to what is real for most of the vast majority of members of PERS. Both of these problems, both of these aspects of it, we feel like will exacerbate a problem that is especially coming about in the teaching field, and that's attraction and retention of personnel. Right now, as far as school wages are concerned, school wages ran 9.1% behind private sector wages between 1989 and 1997. People getting rich teaching is actually not happening. Couple that with a reduced retirement system, I think that's going to contribute to the problem of attracting and retaining particularly teachers, because we're looking at teacher shortages already. And I think many states have experienced this already and are making adjustments in retirement systems. So those features, plus something that someone in the committee brought up earlier, the disparate treatment of employees. Envisioning two teachers teaming together teaching a class, and one's a tier one member, one's a tier three member, and that unevenness for their retirement futures, I think, is something to be considered when looking at benefits for employees. So those are just some of the thoughts of the OEA on this. We would urge you to support the A-10 amendments, because we feel like those provide some real and immediate fixes to employers on these issues. Thank you.
Any questions?
Sure. I guess this is this Bozak about teacher side. I assume this bill, and I apologize for not being here earlier for all the testimony, but it's in another committee. Does this bill affect school districts as well? I assume that's a governmental entity, hence they get affected as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, yes, it does. The opt-out provision that we were talking about, school districts are not. They are listed among the entities that aren't able to opt out of the PERS system, but the other provisions of the bill, yes, school districts are affected. The opt-out provision applies mostly to local governments. And community colleges, school districts are exempt in the state are exempt from the opt-out provision.
Can I just follow up on that? What's the rationale for that? Why are school districts out? I mean, why would...
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I would assume that the rationale would be the vast numbers of people. When you look at school districts, I mean, we represent 43,000 members, PERS members alone. That doesn't include administrators and many other people who are in the schools. And I would think that the vast majority would, that. Plus, so that's the, I would say that would be the piece on the opt-down.
So you're more akin to members of Oregon Public Employees Union? Is that part of because the state gives
is such a large fund, or you're considered different than, i.e., school districts are considered different than a local government in this case?
I'm not following.
Somehow you've been differentiated in this. I guess I'm trying to figure out why.
Can I try?
Sure.
Go ahead, man. The short answer is government entities. State government entities, all the state agencies are pooled into one rate. School districts are all pooled into one rate. So if you remember when PERS testified, they said that once you pooled, it's almost impossible to allow for an opt-out. You can't do both. I'm sorry.
I
mean, that is the issue, because once you pooled local governments, then it would be very difficult for them to opt out as well.
And in those entities that are pooled, they're probably not pursuing the opt-out because they're not experiencing the same potential rates of increase that some of the local governments are experiencing because they're not pooled.
And PERS had testified that if local governments had been pooled with current circumstances being what they are today, their rate increases would be about 1%. So all our employers, all the local government employers that we represent, would not be experiencing huge rate increases that they are had they been pooled.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, and that is the point. State and school district employers are not experiencing rate increases the way certain local governments are. And I must say certain local governments, and that needs to be stressed here, and I don't think has been stressed enough. There are a few local governments that have experienced significant rate increases. Senate Bill 722 with the dash-in addresses those. But there are many other local governments that have different circumstances and have not experienced those rate increases.
Any additional? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Ms. Hunter still here? And Brian Glashmet? And then the final group will be from the fire party. And we're going to try to wrap up by about 6:10, so that's about 10 minutes for each group. So if you could go ahead and just proceed. And
thank you very much. For the record, I'm Brian DeLeishman. I'm representing actually four groups today. I do have a memo for you, and I will not read that, but try and highlight it very quickly, and hopefully won't take 10 minutes. But let me start by saying that 4 years ago, there was a legislative task force put together that established Tier 2. And at that point, there hadn't been any major revisions of HERS for a number of years. I participated in that task force along with members of the legislature, employer groups, and other labor unions. At that, and we struck a deal at that time as to what is currently Tier 2. Let me express to you now my disappointment in coming 4 years later in front of you and discussing a Tier 3. So it was my belief at that time when Tier 2 and the negotiations occurred that we were going to let that work its way through the system to find out what kinds of savings we would get farther down the road. To come before you now and try and redesign a whole new system for new employees is somewhat disappointing to me. With that, the second comment I'd like to make is in relationship to Representative Devlin's question about the balancing act between utilization of sick leave versus the need or the cost to a local jurisdiction, let's say a school district that has to replace a teacher that takes some time off for sick leave utilization. Let me tell you right up front, my wife is a school teacher. She's been at Staten Elementary School for 26 years. She's Teacher of the Year this year. I'm very proud of her. She does her job. In 26 years, she's taken 3 days of sick leave. 3 days. Because she knows two factors. One is when she's not there, it costs the school district money and sick leave to replace her. And she's conscientious. but let me not fool you at all. When she started as a freshman teacher, one of the Wiley veteran teachers took her aside and says, don't squander your sick leave. He says, not only is it good for the district, save them money, but also you can use it on your PERS retirement. If you take it away on tier three, there is absolutely no guarantee that the market will continue to do what it's doing now. And tier two in the future, that we won't go back to people using, other than those people that have started in tier two in the first 4 years with the market going up. That in fact, sick leave utilization and the accumulation of that is not a benefit to local jurisdictions. The cost now versus the cost later. So I just wanted to express that, and that was your question there, and there is really a very fine balancing act there on that particular piece.
Mr. Chairman, if you might say,
yes.
I don't think I asked a question about sick leave. I do think it came up in the testimony. It may have been.
Actually, I'm going to Representative Gardner. I do apologize for that. Now, let me get down to a couple of the points that I wanted to touch upon that really haven't been touched on to this point. This memo was written actually on behalf of my representation of basically public safety officers in the state, the Oregon Council of Police Association, Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and FOPL. As been indicated, and I know the Bob Livingston from the firefighters is going to expand a little bit on this, but the Tier 3 without the money match, in fact, creates a substantial problem and reduced benefit for public safety officers, particularly in my case, some of the numbers that I've seen, policemen. We did historically, because of the life expectancy of police and fire, allow them to go out after 25 years. And that is unique to public safety officers. What we've done with a Tier 3 under this system is create a benefit that is substantially lower than the current Tier 1 or Tier 2. And these folks, if they go out at 25 years, which is typically in the 50 to 52 year age group, and then by the time under this new system they'd be eligible for Social Security, you're talking about 68 years of age, you create up to 18 years of a gap in which their benefits being paid by PERS, and they don't get Social Security, then in fact they cannot make a go of it. The response in the Senate side was, well, there's no reason why they couldn't work a little longer. If they can't make it on that, let them work a little longer. Well, I submit to you, what kind of a pat on the back is that for public safety officers who put their lives on the line? They have a shorter life expectancy. They will not be able, if they work longer, to enjoy the benefits of their retirement. I think that's a little unfair. The next point I'd like to make that's actually been brought up, but let me expand in light of public safety officers, is portability issue. It is not uncommon for public safety officers to switch between jurisdictions. One example that you may be well aware of is Bernie Giusto, who was with the state police. Bernie Giusto is now the chief of police in Gresham. Now, I would submit to you that if a public employer were to opt out of PERS, then, in fact, that would affect the ability for local jurisdictions to recruit qualified candidates, whether it's a new chief or whether it's that protective sergeant that they need in their small jurisdiction that may have come out of Portland ranks, but decides that Corvallis is the place they want to live, or Eugene, where there's a better opportunity. And that local jurisdiction has opted out. They will not take those positions because of the third reason. The third reason, the point that I would like to make, is that with opt-out provision, there is no provision in this bill at all for a public safety officer to be able to retire after a combined between a number of different systems of 25 years, as they currently can under the PERS system we have now, which is 25 years under PERS, you can go out for early retirement. So the example I would give you is that a public safety officer, let's say, that works for Washington County Sheriff for 15 years and is recruited to go to Tigard, Hillsborough or Beaverton, and they opted out, and they were to work another 10 years, they would not be able to retire after 25 years of total service. They would have to work another full 25 years in the new employer for some years and then move back to another PERS employer to finish the 25 years. That is a real incentive not to seek the best possible avenue, jurisdiction for their talent. And it is a real hindrance to those jurisdictions recruiting qualified people. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Questions from the commission?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Could you comment on your membership? How many people work their entire lives in their occupation? I mean through retirement, you know, up to the point.
I guess let me answer that in a couple of different. I represent the Oregon Nurses Association.
That's what I'm asking.
Nursing is a very tough occupation. It's an occupation that has a very high burnout rate. Financially, it's not a very beneficial position. I know a number of nurses that have been working 20, 30, 40 years, some for public employers and some for private employers. But if I had to guess how many stick it out for 30 years in nursing, probably less than half. I mean, I know a lot of them that go into real estate or they go back to school and they become a teacher. Not that that's any better. But they change occupations. As far as police officers, I think it may be slightly different. Police officers is kind of like a firefighter or a police officer when you're a little kid and you say, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'm going to be a firefighter. I want to be a police officer. Once they get into that kind of line, they tend to stick it out a little bit more. But also, I guess the other point is, what else are they qualified for besides, of course, selling real estate or something else, too? It's kind of... It's this professional occupation that they get into. So I'd say that's probably higher.
Follow up?
Yeah. Go ahead. And I know we need to get out of here. I guess, you know, the PERS system was set up, as I understand it, really to address the fact that I believe public servants do tend to stay longer in their jobs, and hence this is an incentive. And I noticed... there was a discussion, I think, in 1995. There was a task force that looked at retirement benefits. I guess the question, why I was probing at this a little bit, is the workforce is changing a lot. Now, as we look on my generation, I'm in more jobs than my father had, and that's the trend. I guess is that, and once you're vested in PERS, and I assume that, again, it takes 5 years, as I recall, once you're in, you're in. So if you go in and out, you can still keep up some benefits. Once you come back in, you pick up where you left off. It's more of a policy question. I mean, is the workforce changing that would require us to make another change to PERS? I mean, this system, the Tier 3, and I'll be honest, I haven't looked at this that closely yet, but is it somehow trying to align itself more to changes in what's happening in the workforce and what is being commonplace with retirement benefits? We have a defined contribution program. We have 401ks in the private sector. There's a lot more mobility, I guess. Is this somehow trying to address that? Trying to get at some just pure cost issue? Is that
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't believe in my setting through most of the hearings on the Senate side that I ever got the impression that the Tier 3 was an attempt to align itself with the dynamics of the new and evolving workforce. It was very clear that Tier 3 was designed to reduce costs and reduce benefits, plain and simple. And I think that creates some problems.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Amy Hunter, representing the American Federation of Teachers. We represent over
80. Thank you.
We represent over 8,300 employees, both in the private and public sector. Specifically to the public sector, classified employees in the K-12 school systems, classified staff and faculty in community colleges, and faculty and graduate teaching fellows in four-year institutions who have a pretty varied membership. And I won't take up much time. I realize the late hour, and I'd like for my colleagues to get a chance, because much of what I would like to say has been said by previous speakers, so I'd like to echo the fact that AFT is in support of the bill with the exception of the opt-out provision and the creation of the third tier. I'd like to draw your attention to something Mr. McDonald said previously, which was we should try and get the highest benefit level possible, of course, with cost containment in mind. But I'd like to draw your attention to specifically our classified staff in K-12 that we represent. If you look at someone that is a special ed assistant in the Portland schools right now, their salary is about $17,000 a year. And they're dealing every day with kids that are severely disabled and providing not just teaching and care, but physical care. A lot of duties which you would typically think maybe a nurse or someone like that would do. And if you're proposing a third tier, which might end up being about 46% to 58% of their income, you're not looking at a very good benefit. And again, we would like our members to be self-sufficient when they retire, and we don't believe that with such a third tier they would be able to do so. Secondly, we also oppose the opt-out provisions for the stated reasons. We don't find that the opt-out would maintain a stable system and that would need to be looked at. We would also support the concept of an interim study of these proposals, but would strongly support a bill without them should you choose to adopt the A-10 amendment. And with that.
You're just fine to support the A-10 amendment?
Yes. And, but oppose the bill in its current form.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, Legislative Director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I'm also a firefighter here in Salem. As mentioned from previous speakers, they noted that I was going to talk a little bit about the goals. Alright, how about if I speak a little louder? Alrighty. What I want to just briefly start off with, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about the third tier and what it really does. Clearly, it's a reduced benefit for prospective employees. There's no question about it. It's going to be a reduced benefit than what is currently able for Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees to achieve. The goals of the PERS was brought about by a consortium of folks, labor management, PERS board members, people that are actuaries that know the retirement system. They were all brought together, and they came up with some goals. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just read. This was what they came up with on February 11th, 1997, in regards to what they believe is a sound goal to achieve in regards to a retirement benefit.
Have you provided that to us?
I have not, and I apologize. I will have that for you tomorrow as for written testimony. I'll break that down. This is real brief here. And if I can quote from the goals handbook itself. Retirees' income vary based on salary, years of service, tax liability, level of Social Security benefits, and many other factors. For this reason, retirees are considered to have the same standard of living immediately after retirement as enjoyed immediately before retirement if their income after retirement equals 75 to 85% of their pre-retirement gross income. With that in mind, if we examine the Tier 3 the third tier pension plus annuity benefit that's proposed in Senate Bill 722, Mark Johnson, the actuary, has stated that for police and firefighters that are in the system, that he projects that would be a benefit. A third tier provides for 47 to 53% of pre-retirement gross income. Let me say that again: 47 to 53% of pre-retirement gross income. And as mentioned by their own goals that have been established by a consortium of folks, that doesn't get you anywhere close to the 75 to 85% goal. Now, over in the Senate, there was some confusion in regards to, well, do we add Social Security or do we not?
based on their own goal, I would argue that you do not add Social Security because it says immediately after and immediately upon retirement. This is not just for police and firefighters, but it's exacerbated a little bit more with police and firefighters because right now, for obvious reasons, police and firefighters retire between age 50 and 55. And if we look at that and examine that, we already know this is a prospective bill for prospective employees. The federal government has already established that right now the minimum age for prospective employees to achieve a Social Security benefit is 68. And this is also assuming that you have a Social Security benefit available and at a level of 25%. So theoretically, for police and firefighters, you can have a gap of 18 years where you're not achieving that same standard of living because you're not able to get some of that Social Security. You're not eligible for it. So there's a huge gap, and this gap, when we refer to the gap, that is what we're talking about. We have huge concerns with that. Further, what I would like to mention about the gap is that with Social Security, like I mentioned before, we're not even sure if it's available. So I think we need to keep that in mind with it. And Pat is going to address some of the other positions that the firefighters have in regards to where we are on the bill. One thing I would like to mention is that there has been, and Brian mentioned it before in previous testimonies, he talked about, hey, you can go out and you can get another job and do that. But there has been mortality studies that have been done for firefighters, and this is a very conservative figure that I'll throw out to you that has been performed by our international, and the average age for a firefighter to die from mortality from obvious reasons because of the physical demands of the job is age 69. So now, when you look at that coupled with an increased age in Social Security, they can enjoy that goal of 75 to 85% per year if they're an average. And as I noted, that's a conservative figure. In some cases, there's been studies that show that that's even a lower age, but I chose to use 69 because I think that is a legitimate one and one that has been studied that shows a mortality for firefighters. And with that, I would field any questions and then hand it over to Pat to finish up our testimony.
Members of the committee, any questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters, also a Salem firefighter, for 24 years. I would kind of like to possibly put some of this in perspective philosophically. The A-10 amendments, which we've been talking about today, they deal with the real problems that are in the current system. The problems that we've had, we've talked about the variable annuity, pooling of local governments, and with the other options of having the members get their, the employers get their credit earnings at the same time as the employees. We've also heard testimony from PERS that said if the pooling of local governments alone had been into effect, that the rates for local employers would have only gone up 1%. That's with all the situations, the taxation, all the things that have been happening. We've advocated the four fixes to the PERS system from the beginning of the session. If you take into account the issues that are raised in the A-10, I would guess that you would actually be seeing an employer rate reduction had they been in effect over these last two or three years, as opposed to an employer increase. If you take into account the other things, when you ask the director of PERS to list the advantages and disadvantages, it became very clear that all the advantages to the Tier 3 were to the employees. All the disadvantages were to the employees. It was very clear that the call. That's how the split happened. And if you do the A-10 amendments, over time, the unfunded liabilities of the local employers is going to go away. those are real. None of the liabilities happen. They happen because the employers chose not to pool, because the employers chose not to have the advantage of the variable account. There's also some decisions that people don't talk about that the employers chose. They chose to fund their unfunded liabilities when they rolled in the PERS over a 30-year period. Now, in simple terms, what happens is those monies are not there to earn the interest. And we've had an exceptional interest. The 20%, the 18%, the 14% that have happened over the last few years. So it compounded all these problems. But they were based on decisions that were made. We're not saying that we don't want to fix it. These do fix it. And I think over time, the unfunded liability, the rates will go down. And what you'll have is a system that funds a very good retirement for its employees, and the rate for the employers is in the market of where it should be. And I think, unfortunately, what's happening here is that the rush to go to a third tier is being carried out on the employees' back. I realize their future, but they're also, the people that are going to be running this state, taking care of all the issues, whether they're public safety or employees of the state. And with that, any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
So, it's your thought that the third tier, Pat, is that we had a little bit of haste here due to the unfunded liability that some municipalities and governments are granting currently. Is there any way to obviously, if the third tier is put in now, we can go back later and add more back in if it begins to work as you indicated. If it appears that the two tier system that we have now would have began to function without these liabilities, unfunded liabilities hanging out there, so I'd go back and add some. That's what we have for us now. And the amendment that you proposed takes out the third tier and the opt-out position.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Kind of rambling here, I know, but has there been any discussion about kind of dividing the baby here a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess discussion amongst whom? Again, we've tried to advocate our position from the beginning that the system is a very good sound system. There's some things that got out of control, and if we fix those, that the system will again become a very good sound system, which it is from our viewpoint anyway. Let's not forget that it's 92, almost 93% funded, which is a very good ratio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, one of the things that interests me about this is that the governor has come in and does not support the opt-out, and has said he's not convinced about the third tier, which suggests that he doesn't like it. But he does talk about exploring the need for such a step, which would suggest deferring it, I would think, for a couple of years while we see whether or not these other fixes have an impact. But he also suggests, if we talk about splitting the baby, not so much splitting the baby, but having another baby here, and that is the idea of allowing, he's sent us a letter here saying that the most serious problem has to do with local governments financing their obligations under PERS. He's talking about their unfunded liabilities, earnings differential. And he suggests authorizing local public employers to collectively issue bonds for the purpose of funding pension liabilities. What's your position on that suggestion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I'm certainly in favor of that. If the local employer's unfunded liability gets into the PERS system, it will stop the growing problem when there's no unfunded liability. The situation that I described where the interest rates went from 20 to 18 to 14 over the last 3 years, and honestly, I don't remember what it was 3 years before that, but it's been astounding. Had their unfunded liabilities been in the PERS system, had they been able to invest their monies in the variable account along with the employees to attain the same interest,
no problem.
With the exception of the taxation issue, there would be no problem with the system.
May I follow up?
Yes, Mr. Manager.
Obviously, we didn't sit in on the Senate deliberations and committee on this. I don't know if you had a chance to, but if you did, could you let us know, was there some discussion of this proposal from the governor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I was in on most of the hearings. I know that they certainly read the letter, but I honestly can't tell you what the rationale was, other than that they had done their deliberation and we're going to move it out.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would just mention that this seems like an interesting additional idea. It's worth exploring if there's enough weight to move it. Thank you.
Mr. Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There appears part of the rationale for the opt-out that doesn't sound logical when you take it in conjunction with the items that are supported pretty universally. One of them is if you're pooling, that would mean that the local governments would not experience probably the increases that they've experienced in the past. That was the testimony from the PERS. If you could just comment. And secondarily also, they can't escape the liability that they have already accrued, because once you pool, you're going to pool, but not pool what your prior liability is. So, I don't know, if you can just comment, it doesn't appear logical to me of why you would want the opt-out unless it's simply based on fear.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, I couldn't agree with more, but the opt-out provision works diametrically opposed to the pooling. The pooling works on numbers. Numbers reduce the rate for the employers because of the volume. That's why the state, that's why the school district are not having the problem that the local employers are. Opt-out provisions, obviously, if they are actually used, are going to hurt the rates of the employers that are in, because there's going to be, we're going to reduce the number of people that are in the pool, and thereby, which can pretty much shown that the smaller the employer, the more likely that they're going to have volatile rates. Well, pooling of local governments is being done to stabilize, to make the rates be more flat, and so with the reduction in number of personnel, it's going to increase the volatility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Further questions from the committee?
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
For hanging around and
appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a request that the question comes up about local government bonding for liability. Could we have someone here from the Treasurer's Office at the next meeting?
We were in earlier.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman? Yes, Mr. Bennett.
In fact, if there's enough support, I would encourage us having amendments drafted to add that to the bill as an option. If there's significant interest in it, and it's a matter of simply authorizing local public employers to do it, not requiring them to do it. But if they need that authorization, it sure seems like a great way to help them deal with a serious problem. On the other hand, we'd want to hear from the Treasury about the Treasurer's perspective. They always have a unique perspective on this issue.
Mr. Chair, I believe if you look at the A10 amendments as well as the current 722A, that this, what we're talking about, bonding, is in fact in the bill. I do believe that Maria Keltner noted that there are some amendments to the current bonding that is in the bill, but I believe there's at least a foundation currently in the bill, if I understand Mr. Mannix's question.
I mean, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You mean in the A10 amendments rather than in the bill, or the bill itself?
In both.
Oh.
wonder why the governor made reference to this.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mannix, it was not in the bill when the governor made reference, but it was added by the Senate after his comments, his and the state treasurer's.
I might. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other business before the committee? We are adjourned.
Is that reconvene the
now we're on?
We'll reconvene the committee.
I would move for unanimous consent for suspension of the rules to allow Representative Devlin to vote.
And
Representative Mann.
Because of motion for us to suspend the rules and allow Representative Mannix and Representative Devlin to vote on House Bill 353. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Devlin, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Mannix, how do you vote?
Aye.
All right. And that should conclude our business for today then, and we will then once again adjourn.
Thank you.